Hello and welcome to the Home of Medicine podcast with me, Dr. Amy Burbridge. I'm a consultant in acute and general medicine, and today I'm joined by...
Hi, it's Ben Lovell here, medical consultant working in London in the UK. Thanks for having me back.
Fabulous. So, Ben, we're going to dive straight in with a case, if that's okay.
Okay.
So I've got a 68-year-old gentleman who was admitted to our medical assessment unit with shortness of breath. He's a known patient with a lung malignancy, and he also has a high cholesterol, and that's really all that there is in his past medical history. Now, he wasn't really sure why he was in hospital. So when I was talking to him and when I approached the bed, he looked a little bit fidgety. And when I tried to have a chat with him, he wasn't aggressive, isn't the right term, but he didn't really want me there. He didn't want to be in hospital. And actually, he was a little bit confused. And when I asked him, you know, what's brought you to hospital? You know, any symptoms? He was like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Kept saying he didn't know. And he was not known to have any previous problems with confusion or any sort of dementia. Mm-hmm. This felt new. When I saw him, he didn't have anybody with him. So I was unable to take a collateral history at that time. Mm-hmm. So I looked through the previous history that had been taken by the doctor overnight and managed to get a collateral history at that time from the wife. And basically, she said that he's just not himself. He's been not eating and drinking for about 7 days. He's complaining of pain in his lower back. He's got a cough, but he's not coughing any blood. And actually, that's normal for him. He's been feeling very tired and complaining about feeling very weak and says that he can't lift his arms up. And that's just all he keeps saying is he can't lift his arms up, but nothing else really along those lines. He was weeing as normal. He was constipated, although the constipation wasn't necessarily new for him. The wife felt that the constipation was getting worse. And that was all that was in the history, really. So when I went to see him and looked at the collateral and tried to take a little bit more of a history from him, he did have delirium. He did have acute confusional states. So it was difficult to take a history. And actually, the history that I was going to get, would it be reliable? So I know, obviously, with delirium, you can have that fluctuating levels of confusion. But certainly when I saw him, he was confused and I didn't feel that I could get much from him. Although from the end of the bed, he looked dehydrated. He looked agitated. And when I asked him if he was in any pain, he just said no. When I asked him open questions, he didn't really answer. When I asked him closed questions, do you have any chest pain? Do you have any shortness of breath? Do you have cough? He didn't really answer them. So I couldn't really, at the point of the history taking, which you know is one of my favourite things, listen to your patient, they are telling you the diagnosis. I couldn't listen to him because he wasn't really telling me anything. So what would you do?
The details you've given me so far, everything you've given me has sort of begets another five questions in my head. So I feel like we're sort of exploding terms rather than narrowing down terms sort of in my internal search engine at the moment. Did you say he's got a history of malignancy at the beginning?
I did. He's got a lung malignancy.
And just to be super clear, you're saying a lung, not a long malignancy. Sorry. Just
that's my, is that my accent?
Yes. A pulmonary malignancy.
He's got a malignancy of his lung.
Of his breathing.
L-U-N-G.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha. So this is a guy with lung cancer coming confused. I mean, things that are immediately sparking connections in my head is people who've got a malignancy somewhere and they come in confused. Have they metastasized to their brain and do I need to scan their head? Or have they got a known metastasis in their brain to have a quick look at the notes? It's not the most common reason, I think, to be confused, but that does immediately throw its suggestion up to me there. And he's 68, I think you said. So, and causes of delirium, you've already mentioned constipation as a potential cause to me. But then I would just trundle down my delirium workup, which is looking for infection, looking for a metabolic dysfunction, commonly high calciums and low sodiums is what I normally see in older adults that make them a bit confused. I'd be thinking about any drugs that he's taken that have made him confused. Is he on a staggering dose of opiates or benzos or gabapentin or amitriptyline, things with a high anticholinergic burden? And other things that might make someone delirious, I'd be thinking about pain, urinary retention, and things like that. So that's my general approach to delirium patients. He gets a special mention for his lung cancer. He gets maybe some cross-sectional imaging of his brain if I think appropriate. He said something really intriguing to me, which is he can't raise his arms. So now I'm thinking that's unusual. Just his arms, or is it his is it just his shoulder girdle it's got a problem, or is it his pelvic girdle? Is this a proximal myopathy due to his malignancy, maybe? Or has he got an injury bilaterally to his brachial plexus, to his shoulders? Does he need imaging there? Unlikely to be a cord lesion that going in both his arms, but I really need a full neurological examination at this point as well, which is going to be tricky in someone who's delirious, because the neurological examination is not a passive process for the patient. They don't sit there and take deep breaths. They don't let you listen to their lungs and sort of palpate their abdomen. They have to follow instruction. And I think that's why a lot of us, I think we did a session, a podcast a long time ago called Neurophobia, about why we sort of shrink away from a neurologic exam. It's because it's a coordinated team effort between doctor and patient, and you've got to both be working in the same direction to get the data that you need. And that can be really tricky in people who are delirious, such as your chap. So at the moment, my mind is a whirl, and I would like a good examination and maybe some just initial blood test results, and then I shall pick my way forward from there, if that sounds fair.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, absolutely. And similar to what I did, I went down the delirium workup. Do you use any sort of memory aids for remembering the causes of delirium?
Now, not only do I use a memory aid, but I've published two textbooks which include memory aids for delirium, and I can't remember what it is. Pinch me.
Irony of
Yeah,
that.
pinch me. I've written a textbook about medical mnemonics, how to remember stuff, and I'm staring at it now on my bookshelf. But that pinch me is the one I was taught at medical school for the acronym for the causes of delirium in older adults. Which one do you use?
Same one.
Oh,
Yeah.
yeah.
So pit pain, infection. You can also correct me if I'm wrong. Neoplasia, constipation, hydration status, metabolic, and the environment, I think, is one that we always forget, isn't it? The E and the medications, but definitely environment is a key thing, isn't it? Just from going from home to hospital can also trigger off delirium. And just by controlling the environment a little bit more.
And I think the environment is one of the commonest causes of iatrogenic delirium in medical inpatients. They were delirious when they came in the front door, but 2 days on AMU with sleep deprivation, no external light sources available, complete loss of daily rhythms and patterns. And we actually can induce a delirium in susceptible patients, which is very tragic because it adds quite significantly to their morbidity and their inpatient status.
Absolutely. And you know, if when I go into the medical admissions unit and the noise and the light and the chaos, that almost could induce a delirium in me after like 12, 13 hours because it is so chaotic. So imagine being unwell plus that. It must be really difficult actually. So examination wise, so I can examine him. So I asked permission to examine him and he said yes. So on examination, as I said before, he looked dry. He was quite thin, cachectic looking, but was sitting comfortably and wasn't in too much pain. The first thing I looked at was his hands, and I didn't notice anything abnormal. His pulse was 80 beats per minute and regular. His blood pressure was 110 over 68. When I was talking to him, I noticed that his speech was quite slow, but I don't know whether that was normal for him or whether that was a new thing. I really need that collateral history. But I also noticed in his face he did look tired. On examination of his chest, his heart sounds were normal. His chest, there was decreased air entry in the left-hand side, and it was dull to percuss on the left side completely through the left side. Breath sounds in the right-hand side were normal, and his oxygen saturations correlating with this were 87% on air, and his temperature was 36.7 degrees. Does that change anything for you, or are you starting to think of anything?
So if he's got dullness and decreased energy on the right side, which does that
The
tally
left
with,
side.
sorry, left side, and that tallies with the site of his known lung cancer, does it?
Yes, it does.
So I wonder now, has he got a malignant effusion and white out? So the chest x-ray would be useful here. I think perhaps could be driving an infection or some hypoxia. What was the stats, did you say?
87% on
Oh,
air.
well, there we go. Hypoxia plus or minus infection in the context of a whiteout of one lung in the context of no malignancy. That ties things together quite nicely. So I think a chest X-ray would clinch that particular hypothesis, wouldn't it? And blood test looking for, inflammatory markers. He was an afebrile though, right?
He was afebrile at 36.7. So I did a chest X-ray, or there was already one done actually by the time I'd seen him, and I reviewed it, and there was complete whiteout on the left side of the chest. So I couldn't see any particular malignancy because it was complete whiteout. So whether it was effusion, consolidation, malignancy going on in there, but it certainly could account for the confusion. There could be infection there. And I absolutely really like what you did there. You sort of, and which Nicola Cooper talked about, was problem representation. So if you write down a sentence of what you've got in front of you, which you just did, a 68-year-old gentleman with a known malignancy who's got a complete whiteout on his chest X-ray with decreased air entry and breath sounds on the left side and a hypoxia, therefore the cause of his delirium is probably malignancy, infection, hypoxia, and putting them all together. Absolutely. So, what would you do next?
Okay. So I would make up my mind whether or not I thought he had an infected effusion. I appreciate that's not the correct terminology, but whether I thought there was also infection as well as the effusion. I would make a decision about that, and that would help me guide any antibiotics or not. I would correct the hypoxia with oxygen. I would need to make a judgment call about whether or not he needed drainage of an effusion and how I was going to make that happen. Because it is not so straightforward to do a chest drain on someone with no malignancy. I don't know what his metastasis situation is. I don't want to put these just blind chest drains in. I need ultrasound to tell me there is fluid there, and I'm not just looking at consolidated lung or perhaps an endobronchial tumor, which has caused complete collapse of one lung and associated whiteout. And, I don't want to put a chest drain into that. So he needs to get some imaging of his chest and then a decision made about whether his hypoxia and his symptoms could be treated with a chest drain. And that would take a bit more thinking. More basic things like that. You've told me a couple of times you feel he was dry. So I'd be looking at his fluid status and seeing if I needed to correct that and also correct any underlying electrolyte abnormalities that might be associated with that. And that could be simple as a little bag of normal saline or Hartmann's if needed. I would address pain and I would make a decision about whether or not he needed VTE prophylaxis. And then I'd be thinking about how I was going to safely treat him while I manage all the above in the context of delirium. Does he need to have a DOLS, which is a deprivation of liberty safeguards, if he were actively trying to leave or he was unable to consent, he didn't have capacity basically. So they'd be the sort of the belt and braces approach at that point. I'm still intrigued about this arm not being raised business. So I'll go back and have a look at that neuro exam as well.
Okay, so just think about the arms being raised. Take away the cancer and the confusion. What conditions are going through your mind if you've got an individual whose inability to raise their arms above
Okay.
their head weakness?
I want to know if they can't do it because they're too weak or if it's pain. Because, a painful shoulder, bilateral shoulder arthritis, you're not going to be able to raise your arms because the pain limits you. So I'd want to get a sense of whether there was a restriction due to pain or adhesive papulitis or whether there was a power failure, a motor issue there. If it was power that it was the issue, then I'd work my way down from central to peripheral, trying to work out where their neurological lesion would be.
What about if then added in the malignancy plus this weakness, is there like a paraneoplastic
Well, I feel
thing
like
like
you're hinting towards an extremely rare condition called Lambert-Eaton syndrome, which is, I know, is a paraneoplastic condition associated with small cell lung cancer. I think it's profoundly rare. Have I ever seen a case in my life? I don't think I have actually. And I just know it's quite similar to myasthenia gravis. It's a neuromuscular junction disorder because there are antibodies against, I think, calcium channels or voltage-gated calcium channels or something at the neuromuscular junction. So it's very like myasthenia. It affects proximal muscles. I have an idea it affects legs more than arms, but I'm not 100% on that. And I think the fatigability pattern's different. So whereas myasthenia, they fatigue and get weaker with repetitive motions. With LEMS, Lambert-Eaton syndrome, they might get a bit stronger with repetitive motions. And I've run out of data on that syndrome. That's all I know.
Okay, well, I'm very impressed at how much you knew about it, to be honest. I was also thinking of polymyalgia rheumatica.
Rheumatica, yes, paraneoplastic syndrome, and also polymyositis.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
And dermatomyositis.
they're all can be paraneoplastic as well.
Yeah. So those sort of things were going through my head, although to be fair, they were really low down on the list of possible differential diagnoses. So blood test wise, I've got them in front of me now. What would you like to know blood wise?
I would like, what do I feel like? Let's do his user knees first.
Okay, so his potassium is 5. His sodium was 136. His urea was 9, and his creatinine was 172.
And is creatinine supposed to be 172, i.e., is that his baseline over, as for
So his
creatinine?
baseline's around 140.
So, okay, that's a bit of a rise. Okay. CRP, please.
CRP was 121.
Okay, and again, that could all be cancer related, couldn't it? Or it could be a sudden spike. And then his full blood count.
So full blood count was normal, HB was 12 or 120, sorry. Lymphocytes, white cells, normal. They weren't elevated.
Did you do a CK or a bone profile?
I didn't have access to the CK at the time. And the only thing that I'd got in front of me initially was a blood gas, actually.
VBG, right?
Yeah, so I had a VBG, and I'll just show you what tell you what the VBG showed. So the pH was 7.4. Okay. PCO2 was 7.
PCO2 was 7.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you read much into PCO2s on a venous blood gas?
But okay, so the upper limit for a PCO2 on an ABG is 6, right? That's in my
Yes,
head.
that's right.
So
Yeah.
I think in a VBG, I let it go up to 7.
Okay.
But that there is no, I have not been backed up by any data there. That is just a Ben gut thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So
Okay.
7, and what's
PO2,
the
obviously, we can
voltage?
look at. Yeah. So, yeah, 7. Base excess was 8.2 and bicarb was 29.1.
Okay, slightly elevated then. So that implies and maybe a bit of CO2 retention over time.
Yeah, it could be chronic as well, couldn't it? Potentially, if he's got this large sort of whiteout. Okay. So his glucose was 5.2.
Good.
His lactate was 1.4.
Good.
His calcium was 2.37. And his chloride was 96.
Which is okay or just under normal?
Yeah, that's okay.
It's okay, yeah. So that's a pretty
Yeah.
boring gas. I mean, the PCO2 is out. So you've got a slightly elevated CO2 on your VBG. You know he's hypoxic because you've done the sats, but he's got a normal pH. So
Yeah.
he's not decompensating. He's not someone who's heading towards ventilatory failure based on
No.
pictures you've given me.
No. So I'm going to throw a spanner in the works now, because obviously this is why I'm talking about this case on the podcast, isn't it? So I've just given you the venous blood gas results. So venous blood gas results are a bit weird when it comes to calcium.
Go on.
Why is that? What do we measure on a venous blood gas for calcium?
Oh, it's the ionized calcium.
We measure ionized calcium. And ionized calcium means it's not attached to proteins, and it's also known as free calcium. Now, this gentleman's calcium on his VBG was 2.37.
Oh, okay. So you, if you, as a rule of thumb, if you double that, you get sort of the serum calcium, right? So
Exactly.
2.37 ionized calcium is very high, and that actually comes out at a serum calcium of something like 4.5.
His serum calcium was
Yeah.
4.78.
What? Oh, that's a record
So
high for me. That's the highest I've ever seen. 4.78.
the reason I wanted to talk about this is purely because the calcium on the blood gas was 2.37. Open brackets, the normal range is 1.12 to 1.3, close brackets. However, this high calcium was not picked up by many people.
It wasn't picked up by me just now. I let you say it and I just nodded.
Exactly. So, what I want to delve down into, why did nobody pick up on this calcium level?
Do you have theories or you're asking me for
I've
mine?
got, well, I've got a few theories. I don't know. So this is I've seen two cases like this actually within the last few months. And was really interesting because you look what the normal calcium on a normal blood test, when you look at it from the lab and it gets reported, is like 2.2 to 2.4, 2.5. And you're like, that's fine. You look at it, you're used to looking at that calcium level. And when you look at a gas and you see a calcium level of 2.37, that registers as normal because of pattern recognition. So when we're making quick decisions at work, when we're looking at gases, when we're looking at x-rays, we are using our type one thinking, our quick thinking, our pattern recognition. Have I seen this before? Yes, calcium's always 2.3. That's normal. Move on. And we are always, usually when we're at work, using our type one thinking, our quick thinking. We don't have much time. We don't have much cognitive bandwidth because there are 20 other people to see. I've seen a pattern that I recognize that's a normal pattern for me, so I'm going to park it. And actually, many, many individuals looked at this gas and didn't pick up on that because I'm sure we're used to seeing a calcium of 2.37 as normal. So we just went, And the only reason I looked at this gas and went, oh dear, was because somebody had discussed a case similar to this a few months previously. And I looked at the calcium and I went, whoa, that means the calcium's really high. That means it's four around 4.78, 4.8. So have you got any thoughts?
I think also when you got your VBG, I don't know if it's the same in your hospital as mine. Were you looking at a printout, a bit of paper, or was it on the computer?
I was looking at a printout. So we still, in the blood gas machine, it still
Same.
prints out.
So you get a printed strip. And there's not many or any other blood result we look at like that on a bit of physical paper. Every other blood result we get is on a computer screen and is color coded. It's either red if it's abnormal, or it has an exclamation mark next to it if it's abnormal. And the only blood results we actually physically hold a bit of paper in front in our hand and hold up to our eyes is the printout from the ABG machine, which doesn't have any of these prompts on it. And I think that probably has something to do with it as well. We live in a world now where we're prompted towards abnormalities by the systems, the tools, technology, that's how they were designed to try and improve patient safety. And when we're given results in a different way, we cannot help but process it in a different way. I think back to cases like the horrible Bawagaba case where a doctor was looking after patients and the computer system was down. So to get all the blood results, they had to ring the lab and have them told over the phone in a list. Sodium 136, urea 4.7, creatinine 93. And the act of processing it via auditory pathways rather than viewing it, and sort of it just meant that it was being processed a different way. And a blood result got missed, a very abnormal blood result got missed. And I remember part reading around that case was part of it was we just process information differently via different inputs, different senses. And I wonder if that's got something to do with it as well. Someone waves a scrap of paper with some blood results printed out on it. I can imagine me taking that from in a different perspective than looking at a very familiar layout on a computer screen, which is how we process blood results.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I think there's so many things going on, isn't there? And what I really wanted to do was there's a lot of judgment in medicine. There's a lot of it's your fault. You did that. You made a mistake. And what I didn't want to happen in any case like this is it's your fault. You missed that. Because actually, number one, many people didn't recognize it, so that's not one particular person's fault, but also there's obviously a reason why many people didn't see it, and it is for the reasons that we've talked about, is that actually the way that we presented data, the way that we read data, is very different. And like you're saying, the flimsy piece of paper that's printed out a machine. You're absolutely right. The way we process that is very different. And the calcium level is normal when you look at it on a screen, but on a piece of paper, it's like, oh, well, it still looks normal because we're so used to seeing that normal level. And it's just a really interesting thing, I think, to talk about is how we think about things and how we analyze things depending on the situation. How busy we are, how tired we are, how noisy it is. Is it on a computer screen? Is it on the phone? it massively changes how we interpret data.
I mean, I missed it just now. You read aloud the results to me, and I didn't click it. People ask me sometimes about the podcast. They say beforehand, "Do you and Amy really not know what each other's going to say, or do you, And I'm like, "No, we honestly, we don't know. It's a surprise because you want to have honest reaction, and we want people to actually hear our thought process as we're going through them. That's the whole point of it, and that would be lost if we got together beforehand and said, oh, I'm going to do a case today about this and that." So I just want to affirm that to anyone who's listening. But I did what your team members did. I breezed past a very abnormal result, and the exact reason why is because you said calcium 2.34 whatever, and my brain went, yes, that's a lovely number for a calcium. Please, next, please. It was fine. And whilst theoretically, when you pinned me down, I used a bit of type 2 thinking. I went, oh, hang on a minute, you're right. The VBG gives you ionized calcium. You have to double that to work out the serum calcium rough rule of thumb. And then I got there, but I didn't get there without you prompting me. And I think you're right. I think we have to think about when we spot these in real life, how we approach them, especially from a governance point of view. It's absolutely pointless to go and say to someone, you missed something. Stop doing that. Don't do that anymore. Got it? Brilliant. I'm going to close this data. Stop. Solve. Problem solved. Humans do not work like that. And there's a thing in human factors called the perfection myth, which is basically that we can be perfect if we try. Humans ain't built like that. You could concentrate and be the cleverest person in the world, and you're still going to miss things because we simply cannot maintain 100% focus for any great length of time, no matter how much you practice doing it. And one thing I think works in our favor in the great complex systems that we work in is that we re-review, and we have second reviewers, third reviewers, and fourth reviewers. And we moan about that a lot. A patient comes in to A&E, they get seen by the ED doctor, then they get sent to the medical take, then the take doctor sees them, then they get seen on the post-take ward round, and the consultant sees them. It's like, gosh, there's some inefficiencies in there. And there is. There's a lot of repetition. Yep, true, there is. But there is a purpose to this cycle, and that is that review is a circular process. It is not a one and done. And having different people reviewing means that things like this can be brought to the light, and someone can actually catch what the first two or three people have missed. And I think it does add something to patient safety by having ongoing cycles of review rather than saying, okay, you've had your review now. You can bed down in hospital for the night and we'll see you on the ward round tomorrow. We do it a few times. Especially in those tricky first few hours when patients are in hospital, when anything can change in the blink of an eye. I think we do need to have a system where people keep coming back and saying, how are you doing now? How are you doing now? And how are you doing now? And then reviewing the data.
And we've talked about cases. You've presented cases to me before where the patient's changed within an hour. And the initial diagnosis is completely different to the diagnosis because the deterioration or the rapidity of the change is quite it's big, isn't it? And you're completely right. The reason I picked up that calcium, because I don't think I would have picked it up actually, was because about 3 months prior, we'd had a teaching session about this exact situation. So I, when I looked at it, I was like, oh, I remember learning about this in a reflective session. So the value of reflective sessions and learning from each other is cannot be overemphasized. It was a 20-minute teaching session that we had, and I'd remembered it. And hopefully people listening to the podcast will be like, must remember calcium and a blood gas. And then maybe then next time they see the calcium and the blood gas that's high, they'll be like, no, it's actually double that. Oh, they're really hypercalcemic. Let's start treatment. So hopefully,
That's
by
what we're
reflecting,
here for.
that's what we're here for. Yeah, exactly. By
It's a
reflecting and
big, it's a
sharing.
reflection, but it's a reflection process. And it's nice to hear other people reflect because it, adds to the wealth of knowledge, I think.
Exactly. And I think with reflection comes wisdom. And I like to think that I'm not old, I'm just wiser.
Oh, I'm both.
Yeah, to be fair, I'm both as well. Yeah, right. So when we look reviewed this gentleman and we realized his calcium was incredibly high, we then went back to the case and went, well, actually, is his delirium because of the hypercalcemia,
Undoubtedly,
as well as probably lots of other things going on as
and
well,
the dehydration, yeah, and
the
people are,
constipation, the
yeah,
weakness in the arms.
yeah.
Everything going on, it's probably all the calcium. So we gave him some fluids. There is no clear UK-based guideline for the management of hypercalcemia of malignancy. There are a few suggestions. There's the Endocrine Society guidelines, which were released in 2023. Again, it's not something that we're following at the moment because they do suggest some medication that we aren't using in the UK. So in the UK, what we do tend to do is fluids, and we tend to give a bisphosphonate. And the one that is shown to be better is zoledronic acid or zoledronate. Tends to be better than pimidronate. And we tend to use that as well. The most common malignancies that cause hypercalcemia are breast, lung, myeloma, and renal cell carcinomas as well can. So that's another thing to think about in your type one thinking. If you've got a patient who has got breast, lung, renal, or myeloma, and they are delirious, think this could be calcium. It could be mets as well. It could be brain mets, but it could be calcium. So there are sort of levels of hypercalcemia. Mild is less than 3 millimoles per litre, moderate is 3 to 3.5 millimoles per litre, and severe is more than 3.5. And this gentleman's was 4.78, which I actually think was probably a record for me as well. And he must have been hypercalcemic for a long time. And looking back at his previous bloods, the previous one had been about 2 or 3 months before, and his calcium levels were normal. So definite change in that. So we referred him to the acute oncology service, also had a conversation with the palliative care team and oncology to try and get some further advice, really, as well as speaking to endocrine if needed. And he had fluid, he had his pimidronate, his calcium came down, and actually he was much better and his delirium settled. He had obviously lots of other things going on, which we talked about, but I think the key thing in this one was that calcium level.
And was the hypercalcemia thought to be due to bony mets or due to his lung tumor, the small cell that was releasing PTH like?
Parathyroid, yeah, it was thought to be due to that parathyroid-like hormone peptide, which was, increasing his calcium levels. So interesting, what turned out to be, quite a common thing that we see with malignancy and delirium. Actually, the cause of it was probably not one of the things that we see that frequently with a calcium level that high.
Makes you wonder, because calcium, a bone profile isn't part of a routine workup.
No, it isn't.
I wonder if for delirium, I think I did say at the top of the
You
episode,
did. You did.
I would think about calcium and sodium. So,
Yeah.
yeah, but it isn't a routine blood, is it? You do in, but I guess
And
some sort of
also,
latency in a delirium, it probably is indicated.
yeah, but why on a blood gas? I don't know the answer to this, and I've tried to find it and I can't find it. Do we measure ionized calcium on a blood gas?
Why do we measure basophil levels on an FBC? I mean, we don't look at this stuff. It's just
I know.
junk data that we screen out. Surely we
It's
save that for
interesting,
something.
yeah. And it's just made me think, why are we in every other setting of medicine, when we're testing calcium, we are testing non-ionized calcium. So why, when we do a gas, do we test ionized calcium? There in itself is an innate error in the system.
Chemistry reasons.
Chemistry reasons, yeah, which I'm not clever enough to know about, to be honest, but be interested if anybody does know
Well,
about why we measure ionized calcium in a blood
you've got
gas.
your A-level chemistry by default of being doctors.
That's
So,
true.
I mean, you don't
Yeah,
remember
that's.
that. Don't remember any of
No, do you?
that. No. I vaguely understood the exam.
Gosh. So interesting anyway. So takeaway points for you, Ben.
Let's say I think, number one, when you're working up a delirium, calcium is something to think about. Number two, that little rule of thumb, when you see a calcium result on a VBG, if you double it, providing they haven't got a crazy albumin level, you can sort of get to their serum calcium. And number three, I think it I can't say be, I think it's a bit facile to say be aware of calcium on VBGs, but I guess that really is the point, because that's what you went to a teach about beforehand that made you sensitive to that result. So let's say it here then. Look at your calciums on your VBG and bear in mind that the results are a different range to the one you see in your serum ones. So maybe this happens to someone else now, It'll be what happened to you. They'll be sensitive to this abnormality.
Yep. Think calcium.
Oh, I hate a
Be
catchphrase.
my it's my catchphrase. But what we don't want to do is what we talked about in another podcast is recency case bias, where we now check calcium on every single patient
Yeah.
coming into hospital just in case we miss a hypercalcemia.
Yeah.
So again, you have to employ clinical reasoning to make sure that we don't do that as well.
Yeah. Pre-test probabilities.
Exactly. And I guess if the pretest probability of a 68-year-old gentleman with mal lung malignancy having a high calcium is actually quite high.
Yeah, it is
So,
actually, yeah.
yeah.
You
So I hope you've taken something away from that. I hope the listeners have taken something away from that today. I think there is some key learning points, and I will echo what Ben said about the think calcium on a blood gas, check, double check, triple check, and if in doubt, check the serum calcium. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. And if you have, please don't forget to rate, review, and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Home of Medicine podcast, a podcast brought to you by the EFIM Academy in association with the European Federation of Internal Medicine, a leading organisation in internal medicine. Thanks for listening.